Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If you are preparing to step onto a medical floor, especially aiming for nursing, the topic we are diving into today is absolutely, well, non-negotiable. We are tackling the complex management of tuberculosis TB. It's a major global health challenge, you know, and it demands precision, absolute discipline, and some really intensive pharmacological monitoring.
That's exactly right. And for those of you listening, especially nursing students needing a shortcut, needing to really master the clinical realities of TB treatment, this deep dive, it's your roadmap.
Okay.
Our source material today, it kind of strips away the deep microbiology and really zeroes in on those practical nurse responsibilities.
Like what specifically?
Like understanding the big four drug regimen, predicting their toxicities, which is huge, and implementing adherence protocols. These are key to stop the emergence of deadly drug resistance in its tracks.
So what's the mission here then? What do we want listeners to walk away with?
We want to give you clinical command over this material. The goal is to ensure, you know, not just what the treatment is, but why strict monitoring is mandatory. We're talking about things like hepatotoxicity.
Right, the liver effect.
Yeah.
Using AST and ALT tests.
Exactly, AST and ALT. And also watching for optic toxicity. Plus, understanding how a public health measure like directly observed therapy, DOT, is often the absolute hinge upon which treatment success turns.
Okay.
We'll try to synthesize that full patient journey, you know, from those vague initial symptoms right through to, hopefully, a successful cure.
All right, let's start with the classic patient picture then. When active TB is confirmed, most people, I think, immediately associate it with the lungs. Is that usually where it settles?
Yeah, the vast majority of cases, what we call pulmonary TB, do indeed center in the lungs. They typically form these things called granulomas.
Granulomas, okay.
But, and this is important, what makes TB so insidious, so tricky, is its ability to disseminate.
Disseminate, meaning spread.
Exactly. The bacteria can travel far beyond the respiratory system. And when this happens, we get what's called miliary TB.
Miliary TB. That sounds serious. What does that term specifically imply about how bad the infection is?
Well, the name itself gives a clue. Actually, if you're familiar with radiology terms, miliary refers to millet seed.
Like the brain.
Precisely. So when physicians look at a chest x-ray or maybe scans of disseminated infection elsewhere in the body, the lesions look like tiny scattered seeds just sprinkled all over the tissue.
Wow.
And that indicates a really severe widespread infection. It means the organism has traveled probably via the bloodstream or the lymphatics.
Where else can it show up besides the lungs?
Oh, common non-pulmonary sites include the meninges, the lining of the brain and spinal cord leading to TB meningitis, the bones causing bone TB or POTS disease. The kidneys are another frequent target.
So this multi-system involvement, it really ups the stakes, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It significantly elevates the mortality risk, which of course makes that early diagnosis even more critical.
Right. So let's talk about spotting it early. What are the common, maybe non-specific symptoms that should signal TB?
Yeah, and this is the challenge for nurses because the early symptoms are incredibly vague. Frustratingly so.
Like what? Just feeling run down?
Pretty much. We're talking about general malaise, maybe a low-grade persistent fever, unintentional weight loss is a big one, and a chronic cough. Patients often complain of anorexia, just no appetite.
Okay.
But the symptom that historically raises the high suspicion, that's the drenching night sweats.
Night sweats? Heard about those.
Yeah. The patient wakes up literally needing to change their bedclothes or even the sheets. They're soaked.
That's pretty specific.
It is. But even then, these initial signs are often mistaken for, you know, the flu or just being overworked, maybe stress.
But if these signs are ignored or missed, the disease can progress pretty rapidly, right? Ooh. And the symptoms change, signaling more severe tissue damage.
Absolutely. If it's allowed to advance, that's when the patient presents with really severe functional impairment. We start seeing dyspnea.
So significant difficulty breathing.
Right. And pleuritic chest pain, which often indicates the infection might be involving the pleura, the lining of the lungs.
Okay.
The presence of these more severe symptoms tells the clinician that the active disease has probably been brewing, often undetected, for, you know, weeks or even months.
Now, let's pivot slightly to the people who are most at risk, because this feels like where the nurse's detective work really matters. Who are these high-risk populations? And why might their presentation deviate from that classic picture we just discussed?
Good question. The primary high-risk groups include, well, the elderly, for one, residents of crowded institutional settings like prisons or long-term care facilities, and perhaps most critically, the immunocompromised.
Okay, immunocompromised. Who falls under that umbrella?
That means individuals with untreated HIV, patients receiving chemotherapy for cancer, or anyone on long-term immunosuppressive drugs like organ transplant recipients.
So if you're the nurse caring for these particular patients, why does your level of suspicion need to be sort of dialed way up?
Because these high-risk groups often present atypically. That classic inflammatory response we talked about, the high fever, the strong productive cough, it's often masked or sometimes completely absent in someone who is immunocompromised or maybe just frail, like a very elderly patient.
Can you give us an example? What might an atypical presentation look like in, say, an older adult?
Sure. Imagine you have maybe an 85-year-old patient, and they're only presenting with unexplained gradual fatigue, maybe some confusion, and a loss of appetite over, say, 3 weeks.
Okay. No cough, no fever.
Maybe no significant cough, and perhaps only a slight temperature elevation, if any. Because their immune system just can't mount that robust response, the classic signs are dampened down.
So the takeaway for the nurse is?
The takeaway is a highly vigilant nurse knows that in these populations, even vague, nonspecific symptoms must prompt a thorough TB investigation, especially given the catastrophic potential of something like miliary TB spreading unnoticed. The lesson here is really, never rule out TB just because the patient doesn't fit that perfect textbook profile. You have to think broader.
Okay, moving from diagnosis into the treatment itself. We mentioned earlier that the entire foundation of TB management revolves around one core concept.
Yeah.
Achieving, essentially, 100% compliance. If we fail there.
If we fail there, the consequence is catastrophic. It's drug resistance.
Creating superbugs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Strains of TB that are untreatable by our best first-line agents. Therefore, the strategy is defined by two key elements. Combination therapy using multiple drugs and long duration. We have to hit the organism hard and keep hitting it persistently.
Which brings us to the big four.
The big four. The four first-line drugs that, yes, every nursing student absolutely must memorize.
Let's list them out.
Okay. We use INH, which is isoniazide. Then there's rifampin, pyrazinamide, often just called PZA, and ethambutol.
INH, rifampin, PZA, ethambutol. Got it.
And these four drugs are selected very specifically because they target the mycobacteria at different phases of their life cycle and also in different tissue environments within the body. This makes it much harder for the bacteria to survive and mutate.
And the treatment isn't quick, is it? It's a standard, what, 6-month regimen for active drug-sensitive TB.
Huh.
And it's structured into two distinct phases. Let's break that down.
Right. 6 months is the standard for drug-susceptible pulmonary TB. Phase one is what we call the intensive phase.
Intensive phase. Okay.
It lasts for the first 8 weeks, so roughly 2 months. And during this time, the patient takes all four drugs daily. INH, rifampin, PZA, and ethambutol.
All four. Every day for 8 weeks. Wow. What's the rationale behind throwing, you know, the whole kitchen sink at it? Right from the start.
The purpose is rapid and comprehensive sterilization. We're aiming to quickly reduce that massive bacterial load in someone with active disease. And also, critically, to ensure that any organisms that might already carry a natural sort of random resistance to one specific drug are quickly eliminated by the other three before they get a chance to replicate and spread that resistance.
So it's an aggressive upfront approach.
Exactly. It's designed to prevent resistance emergence right away and also to make the patient non-infectious as quickly as possible, which is important for public health.
And then, once that initial high kill phase is over, after 8 weeks, we scale back the regimen, recognizing that the remaining bugs might be slower growing but still need tackling.
Precisely. That transitions us into phase two, which is the continuation phase.
Continuation phase.
This lasts for the remaining 4 months, bringing the total treatment duration up to that 6-month mark.
And what happens in this phase? Do they stop some drugs?
Yes. Typically in this phase, PZA and ethambutol are dropped. The patient continues only with INH and rifampin.
Just INH and rifampin for the last 4 months.
Correct. And the crucial point here for nursing education is really emphasizing that just because the patient feels completely well after maybe 2 or 3 months, which they often do.
Yeah, they probably feel much better.
Much better. But they absolutely cannot stop the medication early. If they do, all that hard work and dealing with the potential toxicity we'll discuss, it was all for nothing. The disease can reactivate, possibly in a resistant form.
That commitment is key. So we've covered active TB. But not every patient needs that full 6-month quadruple therapy, right? What about latent TB? Someone's infected but not sick.
Right. Latent TB infection, or LTBI. This means the patient is infected with the bacteria, M. tuberculosis, but they aren't infectious to others, and they don't exhibit active symptoms. They have a much lower bacterial load.
But they're still at risk.
They are. They're at a significant risk of developing active TB disease later in life, maybe years later, especially if their immune system weakens.
So what's the treatment goal in that case? Just prevention.
Exactly. The goal is prophylaxis, preventing the future activation of the disease. And consequently, those treatment regimens are generally shorter and use fewer drugs.
What are the options there?
Well, the original gold standard was 9 months of INH taken daily. But newer, shorter protocols are often preferred now for adherence reasons. These might include, say, 4 months of rifampin daily, or maybe a 3-month course of INH plus another drug called rifapentine taken just once a week.
Shorter and simpler, then?
Generally, yes. The duration and complexity are reduced because the bacterial load is much lower, but adherence is still absolutely vital to prevent that future development of active disease.
And finally, you mentioned prophylaxis is recommended for high-risk individuals. Does that extend beyond just those with LTBI or close household contacts?
It does. Prophylaxis, or preventive therapy, is definitely recommended for anyone with close exposure, like a family member living in the same house. But also, and this is very important for our audience today, for healthcare workers.
Okay. Us.
Yes. If you, as a nurse or other healthcare professional, have a recent positive TST, that's the tuberculin skin test, or a positive IgRA, the interferon gamma release assay blood test, especially if you know you were negative before a conversion,
right,
you likely fall into that high-risk category. And that necessitates a serious discussion with occupational health or your provider about taking preventive therapy. It's to protect both yourself and, importantly, your future patients from potential transmission.
Okay, let's unpack this pharmacology now. We're moving into the really critical safety profile of each of these big four drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And for nursing students listening, this isn't just, you know, a list of possible side effects to memorize for an exam.
No, absolutely not.
These are the things you must actively monitor for and things you must teach your patients about immediately. Because ignoring these warnings can turn a therapeutic medication into a really toxic burden.
Right.
Couldn't have said it better. These are potentially serious adverse effects. Let's start with INH, isoniazid. It's a cornerstone drug, highly effective, but it carries a significant dual risk, neurological damage and liver injury.
Okay, let's drill into the neurological risk first. You mentioned peripheral neuropathy and vitamin B6 deficiency. Why is B6 or pyridoxin so essential here? What's the connection?
Yeah, this is where understanding the mechanism actually helps you remember the intervention. INH acts as a pyridoxin antagonist.
Meaning it works against B6.
Essentially, yes. Mm. It interferes with the metabolism and the action of vitamin B6 in the body. Now, B6 is a really necessary cofactor in many neural processes, including the synthesis of GABA.
GABA, the inhibitory neurotransmitter.
Exactly. It helps calm nerve activity. So when B6 levels drop because of INH, GABA production decreases. This can lead to neuronal irritability and instability, which clinically manifests as peripheral neuropathy.
What does that feel like for the patient?
Typically, it's burning, tingling, or numbness paresthesias, often starting symmetrically in the feet and hands.
Okay. Therefore, the proactive nursing action seems pretty clear and non-negotiable here.
It is. Supplementation with vitamin B6, usually in doses of 25 to 50 milligrams daily, is required for virtually every patient on INH to mitigate this specific risk.
So you give B6 with the INH?
Routinely. And the nurse needs to be really vigilant about assessing for and reporting any clinical signs of neuropathy, asking the patient about, you know, gait instability, burning feet, difficulty buttoning shirts, loss of sensation.
And you mentioned contraindications earlier. Why is pre-existing neuropathy or something like diabetic retinopathy an absolute red flag for using INH?
Well, both diabetic retinopathy and pre-existing peripheral neuropathy, which is a very common complication of diabetes anyway,
right,
already involve damage to small blood vessels and nerves. So introducing a drug like INH that actively disrupts B6 metabolism and directly threatens nerve function is simply an unacceptable risk in most cases. You'd likely be rapidly and severely worsening the patient's pre-existing condition. Patient safety has to come first.
Makes sense. Okay, moving to rifampin. This is the one that guarantees a visible, maybe even shocking, side effect.
Rifampin is certainly the most memorable for patients, yeah, because it turns all body fluids, we're talking urine, sweat, tears, saliva, even potentially stool, a benign but definitely alarming red-orange color.
Red-orange, okay.
This needs to be explained very clearly on day one so the patient doesn't panic when they see it.
Does it cause other issues besides the color change?
It can also cause flu-like symptoms, sometimes fever, chills, muscle aches. But honestly, the color change, while startling, is usually the least of the nurse's clinical concerns with rifampin.
Wait, if the discoloration is benign, harmless, what's the more critical aspect of rifampin that the nurse absolutely must track?
Its drug interaction profile. Rifampin is a potent inducer of the cytochrome P450 enzyme system in the liver.
Ah, the P450 system. That metabolizes lots of other drugs, right?
Countless other drugs, including things like hormonal contraceptives, birth control pills, warfarin, which is a critical blood thinner, certain HIV medications like protease inhibitors, some anti-seizure meds. The list is long.
So by inducing or speeding up this P450 system, what does rifampin do to those other drugs?
By supercharging P450, rifampin basically causes the liver to metabolize these co-administered drugs much, much faster than usual, which dramatically reduces their concentration in the bloodstream and therefore their effectiveness.
So a major nursing education point here goes way beyond just warning about orange tears.
Oh, absolutely. This is huge. The nurse must perform a thorough medication reconciliation, review every single medication the patient is taking, including over-the-counter stuff and supplements.
And what are the key interventions based on that?
Well, for example, if a patient is on oral contraceptives, the nurse must counsel them immediately that rifampin renders them ineffective. They absolutely need to switch to a reliable barrier method like condoms or consider an alternative like an IUD to prevent unintended pregnancy during treatment and for a while after.
Okay, that's critical. What about warfarin?
If they're on warfarin, their dose will almost certainly need to be increased, sometimes significantly. And their clotting times, the INR, must be monitored much more frequently and aggressively to ensure they stay within the therapeutic range. Failing to adjust could lead to blood clots.
Serious implications.
Yeah.
Okay, next up. Pyrazinamide, or PZA. This one carries a specific risk profile involving the joints.
Yes, PZA's primary adverse effect to watch for is that it can precipitate acute gouty attacks.
Gout, how does it do that?
PZA reduces the kidney's ability to excrete uric acid. So it leads to hyperuricemia, elevated uric acid levels in the blood.
Right.
And when uric acid levels get too high, it can crystallize out in the joints, most classically in the big toe, causing the intense pain and inflammation of gout.
So connecting this back to clinical practice, during that intensive phase when the patient is taking PZA, what subjective data should the nurse be actively asking the patient about?
The nurse must actively inquire at every visit about any new joint pain, swelling, redness, or stiffness, especially in the extremities like the feet, ankles, knees, or hands.
Any other major risks with PZA?
Yes. PZA is also a significant contributor to hepatotoxicity, the liver damage risk, alongside INH and rifampidin. It's another reason why that liver monitoring we'll talk more about is so absolutely critical during the first phase.
Okay, and finally, ethambutol. This one has a really serious, potentially irreversible, vision-threatening side effect.
That's right. The critical and most serious risk with ethambutol is optic neuritis. That's inflammation of the optic nerve.
Inflammation of the nerve connecting the eye to the brain.
Exactly. And if this condition is not caught very early, it can unfortunately lead to significant vision loss, even irreversible blindness. It tends to be dose-related and also time-dependent, meaning the risk increases with higher doses and longer duration of use.
And our sources mentioned a unique presentation related to color vision.
Yes, that's a key feature. Optic neuritis caused by ethambutol often presents initially as an impairment of red-green color discrimination. Patients might say colors look washed out, or they have trouble distinguishing reds from greens. This is often followed by a decrease in visual acuity, like blurry vision.
Because the consequence of missing this is so severe blindness, the required monitoring must be pretty strict.
It's mandatory. Frequent documented eye exams are an absolute requirement for patients on ethambutol. These exams typically involve tests of visual acuity using standard eye charts and specific color vision testing, often using Ishihara plates or similar tools.
How often are these exams needed?
Usually baseline before starting and then monthly while on the drug. If a patient reports any visual changes, blurriness, difficulty reading, or especially if they mention that traffic lights look faded or they can't distinguish between red and green anymore, the drug must be stopped immediately and they need urgent ophthalmology follow-up.
So the nurse's role here is crucial.
Absolutely. The nurse is often the first point of contact. They're responsible for educating the patient about why these eye exams are needed, coordinating the ophthalmology appointments, screening for any subjective visual changes at every single patient encounter, and ensuring those reports get acted upon immediately.
Okay, so this naturally raises a really important practical question. We're giving these potent drugs, right? They're taxing the liver, potentially damaging nerves, affecting vision, and we're doing this for 6 months. How do we proactively monitor for these serious risks in a standardized way? We can't just rely purely on the patient telling us something feels wrong, can we?
No, definitely not. We need objective data too. Since almost all of the big four carry some level of risk to the excretory and metabolic organs, particularly the liver, let's cover the general monitoring protocol first. What's the baseline?
Okay, so general monitoring requires pre-treatment baseline assessments of both liver function, those enzymes we mentioned, and also kidney function, usually checking creatinine levels, for all patients starting TB drugs.
Before they even take the first dose. Before the first dose, you need to know where you're starting from. Then, after treatment begins, periodic monitoring, usually at least monthly, especially during the intensive phase, is required. Because these medications are potent and the cumulative stress on the liver over, half a year can be significant.
Let's specifically drill down now into that hepatic vigilance, the liver monitoring, particularly for INH, which seems to be the most common culprit in drug-induced hepatitis. What are the specific lab targets we're watching?
We rely heavily on monitoring serum liver enzymes, as you said. The primary focus is on AST aspartate aminotransferase and ALT alanine aminotransferase.
AST and ALT, what do they actually tell us?
Think of liver cells, hepatocytes, like tiny balloons filled with these enzymes, are normally housed inside the liver cells. When the liver cells get damaged or burst due to drug toxicity, what we call hepatocellular injury, these enzymes leak out into the bloodstream.
Okay.
So seeing rising AST and ALT levels in the blood tells us that liver tissue is being actively damaged.
Right. So rising ASTALT means hepatocellular injury. But what about elevated bilirubin? You mentioned that earlier too. Does that signify the same thing?
Not exactly. Elevated bilirubin typically indicates a different kind of problem, either impaired excretion of bilirubin by the liver cells, or perhaps a blockage in the bile flow out of the liver, what we call cholestatic injury.
Okay, so bilirubin is more about clearance or flow.
Right. The liver might be damaged, yes, but elevated bilirubin specifically points towards a problem getting rid of bilirubin, which is a breakdown product of old red blood cells. So both rising ASTALT indicating direct cell injury and rising bilirubin indicating impaired clearance or bile flow are critical warning signs of liver trouble.
Okay, this is crucial for nurses. When should they really start to worry? Is it just any slight rise in these enzymes that warrant stopping the drugs?
No, not necessarily. Slight fluctuations, maybe up to 2 or 3 times the upper limit of normal, can sometimes occur and might just require closer monitoring. However, clinical protocols usually dictate interrupting or stopping the offending drug, typically INH or PZA, if AST or ALT levels exceed, say, 3 to 5 times the upper limit of normal, especially if the rise is accompanied by symptoms of hepatitis.
Ah, so the symptoms matter too.
Absolutely. Lab values plus clinical picture. And that brings us to the crucial clinical assessment that the nurse performs.
Right. What's the key physical assessment finding that directly correlates to that elevated bilirubin level, something the nurse can spot immediately just by looking at the patient?
The classic sign is jaundice, the yellowing of the skin and mucous membranes. But specifically, the most sensitive and often earliest place to spot this is scleral icterus.
Scleral icterus, meaning yellowing of the sclera.
Exactly. The yellow discoloration of the normally white part of the eye. This is a very sensitive sign of elevated bilirubin levels.
What other clinical findings might signal hepatitis?
Other things the nurse should ask about or look for include nausea, vomiting, loss of appetite, unusual fatigue, abdominal pain, especially in the right upper quadrant where the liver is, dark, tea-colored urine, and sometimes pale or clay-colored stools.
So putting it all together, if you walk into a patient's room, they're on INH, rifampin, PZA, and ethinketol, and you notice their eyes look yellow.
If you see clear scleral icterus in a patient on these meds, your first move should absolutely be to notify the provider immediately. And likely, you'll need to hold the hepatotoxic doses, usually INH, rifampin, PZA, pending urgent lab results and assessment. It's a major red flag.
Okay, that's clear. So to summarize this monitoring section then, based on this high risk of really severe side effects, what are the overarching contraindications? Who should absolutely not receive these standard first-line drugs if possible?
Well, number one is anyone with pre-existing significant liver impairment. That means someone with active viral hepatitis or maybe advanced cirrhosis. Giving them INH, rifampin, and PZA carries an overwhelming risk of potentially fatal drug-induced liver failure.
So severe liver disease is a major contraindication.
Definitely. Also, as we noted earlier, anyone with significant pre-existing peripheral neuropathy or conditions that strongly predispose them to neuropathy, like severe diabetes or alcoholism, should ideally avoid INH unless it's absolutely necessary. And if INH is used in those cases, it must be done only under hypervigilant B6 supplementation and extremely close neurological monitoring. Patient safety first, always.
Okay, this is where it gets, as you said, really interesting and maybe shifts more into the public health sphere as well. What actually happens if the patient feels much better after that 2-month intensive phase? Maybe they stop taking their medication 3 months into the 6-month course, and somehow we miss this non-adherence.
That gap in treatment or stopping early, it's not just treatment failure for that individual patient. It is the primary engine driving the development and spread of drug resistance in the community.
How does that work exactly? Why does incomplete treatment lead to resistance?
When treatment is incomplete or intermittent, the drugs kill off the rapidly multiplying drug-sensitive bacteria first. But there are always some naturally occurring, slower-growing mycobacteria that might have random genetic mutations, making them slightly less susceptible or inherently resistant to one of the drugs. If the drug pressure isn't maintained consistently for the full duration, these slightly tougher, more resilient organisms survive that sublethal exposure. They then get the chance to multiply without competition, passing on their resistance mechanisms to all their offspring.
So noncompliance essentially selects for the resistant bugs and allows them to take over.
Precisely. It turns ordinary treatable TB into something far, far scarier.
And what are the grades of resistance we then face? What are we most worried about?
The primary fear globally is multidrug-resistant TB, usually abbreviated as MDR-TB.
MDR-TB. What defines that?
MDR-TB is defined as tuberculosis that is resistant to at least INH and rifampin, our two most powerful and essential first-line drugs.
Resistant to both INH and rifampin.
Yeah. If the strain becomes resistant to those two cornerstone drugs, we are forced to abandon the standard 6-month regimen entirely and switch to much more complex second-line treatments.
Which are inherently less effective, probably more toxic, and way more expensive, correct?
Exactly, on all counts. Second-line regimens can involve drugs like fluoroquinolones, like moxifloxacin or levofloxacin, which carry their own significant risks, including tendon rupture and neurological side effects. And for even more severe resistance patterns, like extensively drug-resistant TB or XDR-TB.
XDR-TB, what's that?
XDR-TB is resistant to INH and rifampin, PLUS resistant to any fluoroquinolone, and D resistant to at least one of the second-line injectable agents, like amikacin, kanamycin, or capreomycin.
Wow. That sounds incredibly difficult to treat.
It is extremely difficult. For XDR-TB, we might need prolonged courses of multiple injectable agents, along with other less effective, often poorly tolerated oral drugs. The treatment duration often balloons from 6 months up to 18 to 24 months, or even longer.
2 years of treatment.
Potentially, yes. And the cost skyrockets, the complexity is immense, and the burden of cumulative side effects becomes enormous for the patient. Cure rates are significantly lower for MDR and especially XDR-TB.
This really underscores why ensuring adherence to that first-line regimen is so absolutely paramount. Prevention of resistance is vastly superior to trying to treat it once it emerges.
Couldn't agree more.
But I want to challenge the premise slightly, maybe play devil's advocate. The expectation often seems to be that patients should simply take their pills. It sounds easy. But the reasons for noncompliance, for stopping early, are often not clinical laziness, are they? They're frequently socioeconomic and deeply personal. What are the key non-medical barriers that prevent patients from completing that crucial 6-month course?
That's such a crucial point, and it's exactly why nurses, and really all healthcare providers, must understand the social determinants of health. The barriers can be immense and often overlap. Well, think about it. The cost of medications, even if subsidized, can be an issue. The cost and difficulty of frequent clinical follow-ups, needing time off work, childcare.
Transportation is a big one, I imagine.
Huge, especially in rural areas or for patients without reliable transport. Language barriers can prevent understanding. Housing insecurity. Imagine trying to manage a complex drug regimen while homeless. food instability, and we absolutely cannot underestimate the psychological weight of mental health challenges like depression, substance use disorders, or simply the stigma associated with having TB.
Right. Stigma is still a major factor.
It really is. So asking someone to take 4 powerful drugs every single day for 6 months, while potentially enduring side effects like nausea, neuropathy, maybe feeling isolated, and simultaneously dealing with homelessness or job insecurity, it's incredibly demanding. It's often not a matter of willpower. It's a matter of capability and support.
Okay. So if we know these significant barriers exist, how does the healthcare system, often led by nursing and public health teams, try to bridge that gap? How do we connect the absolute necessity of compliance with the patient's real-world challenges?
The primary evidence-based nursing and public health intervention designed specifically to counteract non-adherence and ensure public safety in these challenging situations is DOT, directly observed therapy.
DOT. Define that for us clearly and maybe explain the logistics. How does it actually work?
DOT is exactly what it sounds like, the supervised administration of medication. This means a trained healthcare worker, often a public health nurse, maybe a clinic outreach worker, sometimes even a trusted community health worker or lay volunteer, physically watches the patient swallow every single dose of their TB medication. Every dose, every day, or several times a week, depending on the regimen.
They actually watch them take the pills.
Yes. They meet the patient at an agreed location, maybe the clinic, their home, their workplace, a community center. They provide the pills, watch them take them, document it, and often use that time to check for side effects and provide support.
Who typically gets put on DOT? Is it for everyone?
No, it's not usually for everyone due to resource constraints. DOT is used specifically for patients identified as being at high risk of non-adherence, perhaps due to those social challenges we discussed, cognitive issues, substance use, or a history of previous non-adherence. It's also standard practice for anyone being treated for drug-resistant TB because the consequences of failure there are so dire.
That sounds logistically incredibly challenging and probably quite expensive to implement on a large scale. Is DOT truly a sustainable long-term public health solution, or is it more of a last resort measure for the highest risk cases?
It's honestly a bit of both. It is necessary. And from a public health perspective, it's often considered non-negotiable for high-risk individuals and MDR-TB. Why? Because the societal cost of treating just one new case of MDR-TB that arises from non-adherence far, far outweighs the cost of administering DOT for 6 months to prevent it.
So it's cost-effective in the long run, even if expensive up front.
Exactly. But the challenges are enormous, no question. Staffing for daily visits, transportation for the workers, maintaining patient privacy and dignity when a nurse visits their workplace or home, reaching patients in remote areas. And the strain on the health system's budget is real, especially in resource-limited settings. Yet when treatment failure means potential death for the patient and the spread of resistant disease in the community, DOT often becomes the ethical standard of care.
Okay. And finally, let's loop back to the nurse's fundamental role in education. Given all this complexity, the long duration, the toxicity, the adherence challenges, what is the absolute core messaging that must get through to every patient starting TB treatment?
The education has to be thorough. It needs to be repeated often and, importantly, delivered with empathy and cultural sensitivity. You can't just hand them a pamphlet.
Right.
The nurse must clearly teach the patient about the expected side effects, especially the alarming but benign ones like the red-orange fluids from rifampin, so they don't stop the drug unnecessarily. And equally, the serious ones they need to report immediately, like any visual changes possibly related to ethambutol or signs of liver problems like jaundice or dark urine for INHP zearifampin.
So managing expectations and empowering them to report issues.
Yes. And critically, you must explain clearly and perhaps forcefully, but compassionately, the severe consequences of non-adherence, not just for their own health reactivation, potential resistance, but also the risk of transmission to their family, friends, and community if they remain infectious longer or develop resistance.
Connecting it to the bigger picture.
Right. And the final message drilled home repeatedly. The full course completion is absolutely critical for a cure, even if symptoms resolve after just a couple of weeks or months. Feeling better does not equal cured with TB. If a patient feels knowledgeable, understands the why, feels supported by the healthcare team, and knows how to manage or report side effects, their chance of sticking with that long treatment drastically improves. Hashtag tag touch outro.
Okay, let's try to quickly summarize this absolutely vital deep dive. For any nurse, especially those just stepping into practice, you absolutely must know the 4 first-line drugs. That's INH, rifampin, PZA, and ethambutol. Memorize them. But more than that, you must be an expert monitor for their effects.
Right. And that expertise means knowing the specific monitoring parameters tied to each drug. For INH, it's mandatory vitamin B6 supplementation to prevent neuropathy, and those monthly hepatic checks looking closely at AST, ALT, and bilirubin levels. For ethambutol, it's those mandatory frequent eye exams, specifically screening for changes in visual acuity and that telltale red-green color blindness that signals optic neuritis. For Fimpin, it's that P450 interaction check reviewing all other meds. For PZA, watching for gout symptoms.
And maybe most critically, across the board, you have to recognize the symptoms of hepatic distress. Not just relying on the lab values coming back later, but spotting the clinical signs like scleral icterus, dark urine, nausea, or abdominal pain right when you see the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the profound threat of MDR-TB is what makes the implementation of adherence strategies, like DOT when necessary, so critical to achieving success, both for the individual and for public health.
Indeed. The knowledge of the medicine, the pharmacology, the monitoring, that's absolutely critical. Baseline knowledge. But remember the complexity of the patient living with this disease and this treatment. Our discussion about compliance really highlighted that often it's the non-medical barriers to successful treatment. Things like cost, stable housing, reliable transportation, mental health support, overcoming stigma. These are frequently the decisive factors in whether a patient is ultimately cured or tragically develops resistance.
So here's a final thought for you, especially if you're heading into clinical practice. While you absolutely need to learn the mechanism by which INH kills the bacteria or how rifampin affects liver enzymes, you must never, ever forget that these broader socioeconomic factors, the patient's lived reality, rather than just the microbe itself, often become the biggest hurdle, the true challenge, in eradicating diseases like TB globally.
It truly requires both clinical mastery and deep social empathy to win this fight.